American singer-songwriter and guitarist Lucinda Williams has one of the most immediately recognisable voices and styles in the music business. She was born in Louisiana, released her first album of cover songs in 1979, and since then she has acquired a reputation for songs which straddle rock, country, blues, folk, on albums which include Sweet Old World, Car Wheels on a Gravel Road, you just heard the title track of that album. Her latest is Blessed. Last year, she received the Lifetime Achievement Award for songwriting at the Americana Music Association's annual honours show. I talked to Lucinda Williams at her home in Los Angeles and asked her what Americana means.
I think it's basically a cross of music, you know, or I think it's a sort of style that draws from a little bit of folk and country and even blues, and it's kind of more described, I guess a description would be kind of more singer-songwriter, acoustic-oriented, I guess, you know.
And also, it's kind of where they didn't know where to put it, so they made up a new category.
Exactly, that's exactly what happened, because, in fact, when I was first trying to get a record deal, I couldn't get a record deal, because that's exactly what happened. They kept telling me I fell in the cracks between country and rock, which is exactly basically what Americana is. That's probably a good description, is just to go back to my experience in the mid to late 80s when I was, you know, people, they were interested, but they didn't have a market for it. They just didn't know what to do with it. And I finally got signed by Rough Trade Records, which was
unusual.
Yeah, it took this punk rock label out of England to sign me, you know, because they weren't concerned about that.
Why weren't they concerned about it? Did they figure that the market would find you?
Well, the European market is just so much more open. Mm. And so it's so different than over here.
You have had trouble finding the right label for your albums. You're now with Lost Highway, I think.
Yeah, and then I got signed, you know, a few years went by. And I was on, kind of bounced around from label to label, because that was when all that started happening, and labels would start up and then they would fold. And finally, I found Lost Highway, or they found me. And so then I had a family and I had a stable place to be. And Blessed was my last album with Lost Highway.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I had a contract, you know, that went through a certain amount of time and albums, and so that was officially the last one.
What are you going to do now?
Well, I'm going to go. I've got some offers. I've got some good offers coming in.
Yeah, I mean, you can call the shots now, can't you?
I'm in a good position.
I reckon. You
know, let's put it that way.
I reckon. Yeah. The other thing, I suppose, is that you spend a long time perfecting your albums. Did the labels get impatient about that?
Well, no. I mean, I don't do that anymore. I mean, I like to be somewhat deliberate when I'm working. You know, I don't want to rush too much. But now I've been able to, I've got a good circle of people around me working with me who I trust. And, you know, I've gotten a lot more secure.
Right. So it was lack of confidence that made you want,
yeah, you know. I think it was just lack of confidence and lack of experience, you know. By the time I hadn't made, hardly done anything, and I wasn't used to being in the studio like that all the time. So, and I was always working with different people, and now I've been working with some of the same people over the last few albums. Like, I have the same engineer, we're like family, and so, and, you know, my band guys, and who I've been working with for several years, and so that makes a difference, too.
I was thinking about, you know, this reputation that obviously is in the past now for you being an obsessive perfectionist, but then that didn't figure with what great live shows you do, you know? You don't,
Yeah. You
just get out there and do it. And
I think I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, feel free.
The whole thing about the obsessive, I am obsessive compulsive, I'll admit it, but not about everything. And I guess I'm a little bit of a perfectionist, but I've never really seen myself that way. I think I just like things to be, I want it to be good, you know. I probably got that from my dad because he was always like that, you know.
Your father, Miller, is a poet.
He's a poet, yeah.
Which obviously influenced you.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. And he was always very, I guess if you want to call it a perfectionist, but I prefer to call it just being a good editor, being able to edit yourself, just working on the craft of writing just to make it better.
There's a quote from your father on West, on the cover of West. You do not know what wars are going on down there where the spirit meets the bone.
Yeah, that's from one of his poems. Isn't that beautiful?
It is beautiful. You had a very interesting childhood with him, travelled around a lot. One could say that it must have been very difficult, but also very stimulating. What was it like?
I found it more stimulating than difficult as a kid. I think I just kind of latched onto it, and I enjoyed the different places and all of that.
The title song of Car Wheels on a Gravel Road is a sad song about a little child in the back seat of the car looking out the window, dirt mixed with tears.
Yeah.
Is that you?
That's me, but as often as sometimes happens, you know, as a writer, when you're writing, you often don't realize you're writing about yourself. And the first time my father heard that song, he came up to me and, you know, told me how sorry he was. He said, "I'm sorry about, you know," and I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, don't you realize that was about you?" And he was saying, "I'm sorry that there was that pain that you had to go through, and, you know, when you were growing up and everything." And, you know, so he recognized me in the song. It was one of the sweetest moments ever between a father and a daughter, you know.
There's a picture on the CD sleeve of Car Wheels on a Gravel Road of three children all holding a flower. That's you and your brother and sister. Yeah,
we're holding, it's actually cotton.
Oh, is it? A ball of cotton?
We're in a cotton field.
It is too.
Sometimes my dad would take us out in the car, you know, just to get away, get out of the house for a while. And this is when we're living. Might have been when we were living in Mississippi, or I'm not sure where that was. And we would get so excited, you know. Oh, look, a cotton field. And, you know, so that's where that picture was taken. And we were holding little cotton balls.
Were you and your brother and sister very close because you traveled around so?
Yeah, we were. When we were growing up, we were. But now we've, you know. My mother suffered from a lot of mental illnesses. And she had a difficult childhood. And then, you know, a lot of that's genetic. So my brother and sister both struggle with that now.
And I think there's a song, is it on Blessed, which seems to be to your brother?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you're living?
Yeah.
Do you not know how he's living?
I know he's not too far from me right now in Los Angeles, and he has someone he's living with, but last time I called, I think I called on his birthday, and I've spoken to her a couple of times, and she can't ever get him to come to the phone. You know, he just kind of, it's not an anger thing, he just kind of shuts down.
Mm. Did you see much of your mother? Your parents divorced when you were 11 or 12. Did you see much of her after that?
Yeah, she still stayed in pretty close by most of the time, so, you know, I would go visit her and everything, and yeah, so she was still very much involved in my life.
A lot of songs seem to go back to her, and you know how people say, well, we've got unresolved business or unfinished business or unresolved grief. I know she passed away not long ago. How are you feeling about that?
It's still difficult. I don't think that ever goes away, you know. I never knew that kind of loss before. I don't think there's anything as difficult as that, except unless you have a child, lose a child. But, you know, it's difficult when you feel like there was unresolved stuff before she died that we didn't really resolve. And you don't ever feel like you had that closure.
I suppose that's life, though, isn't it? Everything is unresolved. Don't you think?
As far as what now?
Well, I don't. Everything. Whatever gets resolved.
Yeah. That's a good point.
You know? There's another, I was just thinking about, there's another lovely song on West, which I think is also to your brother, Are You All Right?
Yeah, that's the other one. Yeah.
Which is a beautiful song and could, you know, could be written about all sorts of things, really.
Mm-hmm.
In memory of your mother, Lucille, and Aunt Alexa is the dedication to West, two of the most important women in your life. Who was Aunt Alexa?
Aunt Alexa, she was one of my favorite aunts. There were two aunts on my dad's side. He had two sisters, and she passed away when we were in the middle of recording West. And, you know, that was another one of those situations where I remember having gotten a phone message from her, because she was real good about keeping in touch and had a wonderful sense of humor. And you know, I hadn't returned the phone call yet. You know, one of those kind of things that, you know, I'm sure we've all experienced that, or the letter that you didn't return and then the person dies and everything. But, you know, she would have understood.
She would. You know, a lot of songwriters, when, or novelists, anybody, poets, when you say to them, you know, is this about you? They say, no, 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 you know, it's a novel or it's a song and it's not about me and it's not autobiographical. You just lay it out there, don't you? It is all autobiographical, end of.
It pretty much all is autobiographical. I mean, even when I'm singing about another person, like the song Drunken Angel, for instance, that's still somewhat autobiographical because I'm singing about someone I knew and was around, and I write from life experiences. That's the easiest way for me to write.
Drunken Angel is one of the kinder so-called kiss-off songs that you write.
Now, he wasn't a lover of mine, though.
All right.
Or anything.
Who was he?
He was a guy who was a bigger-than-life guy in Texas who was a really talented songwriter and singer and lived the rough, hard life and drank a lot and was just, everybody loved him. He was kind of a, you know, big, beautiful loser kind of guy. And he was a big follower of Townsend Zance. And so I didn't know him real well. But, you know, we played in some of the same places and everything. And he was one of those people who made an impact.
A lot of your songs are about the bad boys.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's the easiest thing to write out.
Well,
you know?
Yeah. But what... what is it? I mean, you are not alone. There are many, many women who are attracted to bad boys.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any idea why?
Well, I think it's just it's a seductive thing. I think, you know, there's a certain element of mystery and excitement.
But it's kind of counter-evolutionary, right? I mean, women are supposed to pick men who would be good providers and good fathers.
Right.
But,
well, it depends on if you're going to have children or not, and maybe a lot of that's changed. And although, I mean, when you look back over the course of history, I mean, there have always been the bad boys, you know? So there's always been that element of that.
I think if anybody ever wants to get over a broken or bad love affair, they just need to listen to songs like Come On off West or Change the Locks, and it's really going to make them feel better. Did it make you feel better to write and sing them?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I think part of it is after a while you just kind of get, hopefully you outgrow that a little bit. But the other important thing is not necessarily about whether a guy's wearing motorcycle boots and has a bunch of tattoos and chains and stuff. I mean, I still find that attractive, you know, but, I mean, trust me, My husband, Tom, has enough bad boy in him. He's got a little bad boy in him.
Oh, do you want to explain
I
that
think
further?
I didn't recognize that when I first saw him because he was a record company guy. He was like, I'm dating a record company guy, you know?
A music executive who, did he wear a suit?
No, he didn't wear a suit.
Okay.
But then once I got to know him, I discovered, oh, yeah, you know.
So not too bad,
so that's
though.
That's the trick.
My fingers are crossed that he's not too bad. I don't want to hear a song like Change the Locks.
A little bit of bad boy, just enough in there.
All right.
Like maybe about 10%. Oh. You know, like 15 maybe. But you want him to be mature enough that you can talk about stuff and you can say what you need to say and they're not going to run away.
Yeah. Is this your first marriage?
It's actually my second. I was married for about a year to, believe it or not, a guy named Greg Souders, who was the drummer in the band, The Long Riders.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they had a couple albums out on Island Records. And now Greg is happily remarried, and he's my publisher, or was my publisher, at Warner Chappell.
That's nice. That's civilized.
Yeah. Yeah.
How come it only lasted a year?
Well, you know, we were young, and we just weren't compatible. And I was having trouble writing, and actually, the truth is, we separated for a while, and then during that time, he became this big born-again Christian and started railing on about that, and I went, well, that's not going to work, so, you know. And there were some other things, but he was going through a lot of stuff.
You started singing when you were a kid, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. I started taking guitar lessons when I was 12, but even before that, there was always a piano in the house because my mother played piano. She studied music theory and piano for years and years. I think that was part of what she struggled with, actually, was that she never really did anything with it, and she didn't have that kind of encouragement. When she was growing up, she grew up in that time when women weren't really encouraged to pursue a career, and her folks didn't think much of my dad. They thought he was just this beatnik liberal guy, and so.
How did she feel about your success?
She enjoyed it, and she was very supportive, but she would kind of slip in and out of. I think I'm not really sure, you know. Mm. I mean, she would come to my shows, but that was something we never really talked about. She would go through periods where she would get rid of her piano, and she wouldn't have a piano around. And it almost kind of reminded her, I guess, of something she didn't want to be reminded of, and I don't know.
Mm. You started busking in New York, I think, late 70s, and there's a nice story about you meeting Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
Where was that?
I met him briefly. It was at this place, Folk City, the legendary Folk City little club and little coffee house bar place in the village, in the West Village, and, you know.
Was he performing there?
No, he wouldn't. But in the early days, I think maybe he did. But he stayed friends with the owner. This really sweet older Italian man named Mike Porco, he ran the place until he passed away. But from time to time, apparently Bob Dylan, when he was in the city, he would stop over and say hi to Mike Porco. And he had come in to see the band who was playing that night was from the Woodstock era. I think this was when Bob Dylan was living in Woodstock. And the guy who was performing was Tom Pacheco, and I was asked to get up and do a few songs, you know, as an opener, and at that time, I didn't have that many original songs. I really didn't wasn't real confident that way yet. So I was doing mostly, you know, folk songs and blues songs. But I had just had that first Folkways album.
Right.
Had just come out. So anyway, Bob Dylan came in, and he sat at the bar and listened for a while, and I got introduced to him, which took my breath away. There really was an aura about him when I first met him. And
did you think that he might further your career?
Well, I wasn't sure. You know, I didn't have anything really to show him, you know what I mean? But I think he heard something in my voice or something. I mean, this is when I was probably like 25 or something. And he said something like, well, stay in touch. We're going to be going on the road soon. And I thought, okay, I'm not sure what that means, you know.
And 20 years...
around the Rolling... I'm doing an interview. Okay. This is... Sorry, that was Tom.
Is that 10% bad boy Tom?
He's going to meet... Actually has a meeting with a guy from one of the labels he's interested in. You know, we've been talking at several labels about, like, who we're going to go with next.
Okay.
Kind of thing.
Have you got the next album, you know, under your belt and songs under your belt already?
I've got a bunch of new songs. I'm really excited. We haven't gone in the studio yet, but I'm feeling good about all that and really excited about the band I'm bringing out. I've got my regular rhythm section, Butch Norton on drums and David Sutton on bass, and then got Doug Pettibone back in the band for a while, who was my longtime guitar player, you know, for several years. And we also have, for this tour, we have Stuart Mathis, the guitar player from the Wallflowers.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so they're going to be, this is going to just be a kick-ass band. I mean, I went down to rehearsal last night, and they just sound great.
Get back to Bob Dylan. 20 years after you first met him, you went on tour with him and Van Morrison, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Was that a time of joy?
That was you know, I was so honored. Although, my expectations were pretty high in terms of what I thought it was going to be like, which was we'd all be hanging out every night, you know?
Yeah.
Kind of doing, you know, talking and all of this, and that didn't happen at all, you know? You never saw Bob after any of the shows. I saw him one time, the first night before I went on. He came over and said hi, and he was real sweet and everything, and then...
Did he remember you from all those years back, meeting you then?
Oh, you know, I don't know.
Right.
Not sure, but... Anyway, he wouldn't hang out every night. He would go straight away to his tour bus or whatever. So, and Van kind of kept to himself, and, you know.
That might have been a good thing.
Yeah, I don't know.
I was talking to Nick Lowe last week, and he had done some work with Van Morrison, and he works with musicians that have been fired by Van Morrison.
Oh, five, my God, that's so funny.
Five times.
So
they've been funny. fired.
You could make like a band. You could do a whole band probably of...
Ex-Van Morrison musos.
I remember talking to one of the guys who was playing with Van Morrison, and he said, I don't think I'm going to be around after this. He says, I just can't take it anymore. Or something, you know, like, they just were all walking on eggshells because nobody knew when they were going to be fired.
No.
From one minute to the next, you know.
Whereas with your band, you all seem to be having such fun together.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's no reason to do it otherwise. That was the thing that I found really disheartening when I was on that tour, was that nobody seemed to really be having that much fun. And we were playing these big, huge arenas, and that's when I said to myself, you know, I don't necessarily want to be playing these kind of places. I don't know. I guess it would be different if I were headlining.
Yeah. What's your favorite song on Blessed, by the way? Have you got one?
You know, I would probably have to say Born to be Loved.
All right.
That's the one that I love to sing. Something about it, it really goes over well when we do it live.
Yeah. Kiss Like Your Kiss is very beautiful also,
yeah.
Which was on the True Blood soundtrack, yes?
Yes.
Do they come to you and say, is that how it works? We want to use this?
Yeah, they wanted, we know the guy who does the music for that, he had used one of my songs previously. They put Lake Charles, I think that was in the first season, the song Lake Charles, you know, from the Carvels album. So he was familiar with my music already and everything, so he reached out to Tom and asked if I had any new stuff, because I was writing the songs for Blessed. And so Tom took him two or three songs, and that was one of them. And he liked it.
Perfect. Beautiful, beautiful song. You mentioned Lake Charles, the song on Car Wheels, Lake Charles. Mm-hmm. I wondered if it's your father who used to talk about going back there.
That's a guy that I was involved with.
All right.
He was a big, beautiful loser.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dear, oh dear.
I know. The older you get, the more people you lose and
yeah,
the more you have to write about.
Yeah, I know, I know. But you're never going to run out of things to write about by the sounds of it.
No.
Although, all this stuff about you getting too happy and not wanting...
I know, that's just a bunch of...
Yeah.
Hogwash.
Well, it's a hogwash because Blessed is full of all sorts of textures of songs. You know, you've got the sad and the bad and the good and the wrong and the, you know what, you're always going to feel pain.
And the thing is, I'm not happy all the time. I'm never going to be happy. Nobody's happy all the time.
No.
Come on.
No.
It doesn't matter whether you're married or not or rich or poor or whatever. I mean, happiness is, it's all relative, and some days I feel happy, and sometimes I feel like crap, so...
You have said that Tom has changed your life. Specifically, how?
Well, I mean, when you find that person that you just know is the right one, and...
But haven't you... I don't want to press the point here, but you must have thought that before, right?
Well, yeah, but, you know, Tom was ready. He wanted the same thing that I wanted. To find someone who's compatible, isn't dragging around a ton of garbage, has a career, he didn't have any kids, you know, we're fairly close to the same age, there's about a 6-year difference, he's about 6 years younger. All of those things line up. You're physically attracted, that's great, but you have to have all that other stuff line up too.
Do you think if you'd met him 20 years ago, you would have wanted the same things from him?
I don't know, probably, because I was always searching for that. Because we've talked about that a lot. Like, we wish we'd met each other sooner. Everything happens for a reason, and...
And you wouldn't have been the same person if you'd met him earlier.
Right. Probably not. He was engaged to somebody else for 10 years.
What, when you came along?
Well, no, that it ended before we got together.
10 years is a long engagement.
It is.
What, there was some reservations about actually getting married?
No, she was the one who, she cheated on him, and he said, you know, don't slam the door on your way out or whatever, you know.
How did you first meet him?
Well, it's kind of a long, funny story. We technically met... when I was touring behind the Sweet Old World album, and he was working for Best Buy in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I had to go, they brought me over to do a meet and greet sort of thing.
Best Buy?
Yeah, Best Buy Records.
Okay, sorry. I was thinking about supermarkets.
Not,
wrong. Okay.
Not, or the stores aren't around. But anyway, he worked for Best Buy. So they had a meet and, you know, where you go and say hi to, you know, back in those days, that was when you had record stores and radio stations and, you know.
Yes.
You know, you'd go and meet the people who supported your music.
Those were the days.
Yeah. So I was doing that, and Tom was working, and we met then in the sense of, hi, how are you doing, shaking a bunch of people's hands. And then flash forward 15 years later or something, he had moved out to L.A. and was working for Fontana Distribution, which is part of Universal Music Group, and I had moved back out, and he knew who I was from the business part of things, but I didn't remember him because that was just one day and a, you know, string of a bunch of stuff. Anyway, this is going to sound funny, but I had gone down with my best girlfriend to this hair salon in Hollywood, and we were down there towards the end of the day, and there was nobody else in there, and Tom came in to get a haircut, and he walked in the door, and I went, wow, that guy's really attractive, you know, and he was friends with the guy who was going to cut his hair, so he introduced himself, and he said, I met you back in 1992, and I worked at Best Buy, and so that's how he met, that's how we got reintroduced.
That's pretty spooky, because if you hadn't gone for the haircut, at
I
exactly...
know. And the other thing that's freaky and coincidental is Tom and I both had a mutual friend in Minneapolis who, if she had known Tom for a long time, and she and I were friends, independent of each other, and she had planned on introducing me to Tom, that she thought we would be, she thought we would like each other. But we met before she had a chance to do that.
Gosh, it all seems strangely inevitable then, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Although, you know, you could have got together in 1992 if you'd both had your wits about you and saved time.
Except he was engaged at that time.
Ah, well.
And he was probably wearing Dockers or something at the time. You know. And I've seen earlier pictures of him. You know, he's got his Dockers on, and you know, because they were told they had to dress like that.
And you could never go with a man who had Dockers.
Well, you know, I just, you know, wasn't as mature as I am now.
And he doesn't wear Dockers anymore.
No. He's got them packed up in a box in the garage still. And I keep telling him, honey, why don't you get rid of these clothes? They're just taking up space. Let me take them to the Goodwill.